I mean, the biggest whistleblower revelations over the past decade have involved those made by FBI agents, CIA agents, NSA employees, State Department employees, and Army whistleblowers. And none of those people are protected.
And do you feel that there are members of Congress who understand that and would like to do the right thing? Or do we have a situation where basically whistleblowers are simply shunned and that most members of Congress take their lead from the administration, which wants to silence whistleblowers rather than get to the bottom of the wrongdoing they expose?
I think that Congress does follow in lockstep with the president when it comes to whistleblowers, and certainly the president sets the tone. In terms of how many congressmen are actually helpful to whistleblowers, I can count them on one hand. And there's a lot of lip service paid to the good of whistleblowers, the good that we bring to the process, and the need to protect whistleblowers, but I don't think Congress has that as a priority. And I think if President Obama made that a priority and said something needs to happen to provide meaningful, effective whistleblower protection, at least that would start a debate in Congress. The way the president has said, look, something needs to happen with gun control, so at least there's a conversation going on in Congress. I don't know what will result from that, given, like Bismarck said, it's like making sausage when you look at how Congress operates. But certainly the message gets set at the top. And from Obama, I've seen ambivalence towards whistleblowers or actively hurting them.
Jesslyn Radack, one other question I'll put to you simply and then explain the context. I'm trying to find out who is the new John Yoo. And recently, a federal court judge issued a ruling. And she made a statement in it to the effect that the Alice in Wonderland nature of my ruling is not lost on me. The case before her was an attempt by the ACLU and by news organizations to force the government to reveal the memo that was used to authorize the drone strike in Yemen that killed an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, and the second strike a week or two later that killed his 16-year-old son, who, by all accounts, was not a combatant of any sort, Abdul Rahman, I think is his name, al-Awlaki. And so the judge ruled that because of precedents and the assertions of secrecy, that she was unable to order the release of the memo. And it prompted me to scratch my head and say, well, who is the new John Yoo? Do you have any ideas as to who occupies that office and where these secret memos that we're told give clear authorization for this expansion of presidential power, who's writing them?
Well, I still think the Office of Legal Counsel is at the epicenter of this. In terms of Awlaki, we know that Marty Lederman, who had been a huge anti-torture activist while Bush was in office, later went to the Office of Legal Counsel and drafted the 74-page memo that authorized targeted assassination of an American. And we know all this not because anyone responded to FOIA requests by me or any number of newspapers, but because the New York Times had a front page detailed article, including the length of the memo and its author, Marty Lederman, and its legal rationale. So at that point, effectively, Marty Lederman was acting as a new John Yoo. Marty Lederman has now moved on. I'm not sure who's taken over the helm. I think Barron is still there. I'm not positive about that. But the Office of Legal Counsel continues to be the immunizers and the justifiers for all the wrong things the department wants to do. And then we have Lisa Monaco, who's been the National Security Division head. And she's also been, I think, equally culpable in a lot of these terrible secret policies, dealing with Al-Awlaki and with the targeting of other American citizens for drone strikes.
And could you repeat that name,
Lisa Monaco.
Monaco. Okay. Lisa Monaco.
Lisa Monaco. And she pledged during her confirmation hearing, she was very solicitous towards the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and saying that she would go after leakers.
Well, I think it's important to know who these people are, because I think that John Yoo was correctly identified and has been targeted for public expression, including efforts to deny his tenure at the law school at the University of California at Berkeley. And likewise, I think that it's not a political issue, it's a constitutional issue to me. People who value our constitutional rights and the separation of powers should know the names of Lisa Monaco and Marty Lederman, who apparently are those who are offering the legal cover for what I think are clearly unconstitutional activities.
Another one is Harold Koh,
yeah,
at the State Department, also one of the nation's leading anti-torture activists under Bush, who totally went to work for Obama and drank the Kool-Aid. And somehow I don't think we have the same antipathy for those individuals because they're working for Obama and there's that cult of personality that Obama's okay and we can trust him and that his heart is in the right place. And therefore, people whose names have been public have not been professionally ostracized in the way that someone like John Yoo appropriately has been.
Well, and I refer to that, Jess, as left lawn. You remember Reagan was called the Teflon president. Well, I think they went over to DuPont and got the new and improved left lawn. And, you know, nothing that comes from the left against, that's critical of Obama and his appointees sticks.
I agree. And I think once people are inside the administration, they're quickly drinking the Kool-Aid. But I have to think that people like Harold Koh and people like Marty Lederman are too smart not to realize that they went over to the dark side and began engaging in precisely the kind of conduct that they had condemned and took it one step further to kill lists and drone rationalizations that actually made John Yoo's torture memos look like milquetoast.
Very well put. Jesselyn Radack, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate your outspokenness.
If you knew I was watching you, would more of your steps be dance moves, or would you shuffle round with the V's up at me? If you knew I'd been listening in, would your phone calls to your mum be more interesting, or would you give her the same old platitudes? I work in surveillance for the government, but I've been watching you in my spare time. If you thought I could smell you, would you wear less perfume, or would you douse yourself as usual? If you thought I could reach out and touch you, would you stay, or would you move away to another room and shut the door? Surveillance for MI5, but I've been watching you in my spare time.
And that musical interlude by Clayton Blizzard was entitled Function Creep, which introduces the second part of our show. This is Glenn Greenwald speaking on the US surveillance grid at the World Socialist Conference in 2012. And if you like it, there are more such available at wearemany.org.
I want to just begin with a little story that I think is illustrative and significant in lots of ways. The story begins in the mid-1970s when there were scandals that were arising out of the Watergate investigation in the Nixon administration. And there were scandals surrounding the fact that, as it turned out, the Nixon administration and various law enforcement officials in the federal government were misusing their eavesdropping power. They were listening in on people who were political opponents. They were doing so purely out of political self-interest, having nothing to do with legal factors or the business of the nation. And this created a scandal. And unlike today, the scandal 40 years ago in the mid-1970s resulted in at least some relatively significant reactions. In particular, a committee was formed in the Congress, in the Senate. And it was headed by someone named Frank Church, who was a Democratic Party United States Senator from Idaho and had been in the Senate as of this time for 20 years or so, was one of the most widely regarded senators and was chosen because of that. And he led this investigation into these eavesdropping abuses and to try and get to the bottom of the scandal. And one of the things that he discovered was that these eavesdropping abuses were radically more pervasive and egregious than anything that had been known at the start of the investigation. It was by no means confined to the Nixon administration. In fact, it went all the way back to the 1920s when the government first began developing the technological capability to eavesdrop on American citizens, and heightened as the power heightened through the 1940s when the World War II justified it, into the 50s when the Cold War did, and then the 1960s when the social unrest justified surveillance. And what Senator Church found was that literally every single administration under both Democratic and Republican presidents had seriously abused this power, not in isolated ways, but systematically. And this committee documented all of the ways in which that was true, and the realization quickly emerged that allowing government officials to eavesdrop on other people, on citizens, without constraints or oversight, to do so in the dark, is a power that vests so much authority and leverage in those in power that it is virtually impossible for human beings to resist abusing that power. That's how potent of a power it is. But the second thing that he realized, beyond just the general realization that this power had been systematically abused, was that there was an agency that was at the heart of this abuse, and it was the National Security Agency. And what was really amazing about the National Security Agency was that it had been formed 25 years ago, back in 1949, by President Truman, and it was formed as part of the Defense Department, and it was so covert that literally for two decades, almost nobody in the government even knew that it existed, let alone knew what it did, including key senators like Frank Church. And part of his investigation, and it was actually fairly radical of an investigation, fairly aggressive, even looking at it through cynical eyes and realizing that the ultimate impact wasn't particularly grand, but the investigation itself was pretty impressive, and he forced his way into the National Security Agency and found out as much as he possibly could about it. And after the investigation concluded, he issued all sorts of warnings about the surveillance state and how it was emerging and the urgency of only allowing government officials to eavesdrop or surveil on citizens if they had all kinds of layers of oversight with courts and Congress. But he issued a specific warning about the National Security Agency that is really remarkable in terms of what he said. And this is what he said, and you can find this anywhere online, in the New York Times, everywhere. He said it as part of a written report and then in an interview. He said, quote, "The National Security Agency's capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter." He continued, "There would be no place to hide. If a dictator takes over the United States, the NSA could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back." Now, there's several things that I find extraordinary about that statement. For one, the language that he uses. I mean, this is not somebody who is a speaker at the Socialism 2012 conference saying these things. This was literally one of the people who was one of the most established institutional figures in American politics. I mean, he was in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, but very much its mainstream. For many years, he chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And here he is warning the country about the dangers, not just of the U.S. government, but specifically about the national security state, and using words like dictator and total tyranny, and warning of the way in which this power could be abused such that essentially it would be irreversible, that once the government is able to monitor everything we do and everything we say, there's no way to fight back, because fighting back requires doing it away from their prying eyes. And if you look now 30 years later to where we are, not only would you never, ever hear a U.S. senator stand up and insinuate that the national security state poses this grave danger, or use words like tyranny and dictators to describe the United States the way that Frank Rich did only 30 years ago. Now it's virtually a religious obligation to talk about the national security state and its close cousin, the surveillance state, with nothing short of veneration. Just a few weeks ago, Chris Hayes, who's an MSNBC host on the weekends, used the opportunity of Memorial Day to express the view in this very tortured, careful, and pre-apologetic way that maybe it's the case that not every single person who has ever served as an American soldier or enlisted in the American military is a hero. Maybe we can think about them in ways short of that. And this incredible controversy erupted. Condemnation poured down on him from Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals alike, and he was forced in multiple venues over the course of the next week to issue one increasingly sheepish apology after the next. That's how radically our discourse has changed, so that you cannot talk about the national security state or the surveillance state in these kind of nefarious terms the way that Frank Church, who probably knew more about it, did just a few decades ago. The second remarkable aspect of that story, of that quote to me, is that the outcome of that investigation was a series of laws that were grounded in the principle that, as I said earlier, we cannot allow government officials to eavesdrop on American citizens or in any way to engage in surveillance without all kinds of oversights and checks, the most illustrative of which was the FISA law that said that no government official can eavesdrop on our communications without first going to a court and proving to a court that we're actually doing something wrong and getting the court permission before they can eavesdrop. There was a similar controversy in the mid-2000s, in 2005, when the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration had been using the NSA to do exactly what Frank Church warned against, which is spying on the communications of American citizens. And the outcome of that was not new laws or new safeguards to constrain these sorts of abuses. It was exactly the opposite. In 2008, the Democratic-led Congress, with the support of President Obama and most of the supporters of his in the Democratic Party, as well as almost all Republicans, basically gutted that law, repealed it in its core, and made it much, much easier for the government to eavesdrop on American citizens without constraints, and then immunize the nation's telecoms that had participated in that illegal program. So you see the radically different attitudes that the United States has to surveillance just from 30 years ago, when abuses resulted in a whole variety of weak but still meaningful legal constraints, versus what we do now when we find out that the government is lawlessly spying on us, which is act as quickly as possible to make it legal. But the third part of why I think Frank Church's statement is so remarkable is also the most important. If you look at what he said, he phrased his warning in a conditional sense. He said, if A happens, then B. A was if the NSA starts using its eavesdropping capabilities and not directing them at foreign nationals who we suspect of spying, but instead at the American people, then B will happen. B being, we'll essentially live under a dictatorship. There will be total tyranny where the American people will be unable to fight back because this net of surveillance will cover what we do. And what's really remarkable is that conditional that he warned against, the apparatus of the NSA being directed domestically and inwardly rather than outwardly, has absolutely come to pass. That is the current situation. That is the current circumstance of the United States. The NSA, beginning in 2001 under George Bush, was secretly ordered to spy domestically on the communications of American citizens. It has escalated in all sorts of lawless and now lawful ways, such that it is now a normal part of what that agency does. Even more significantly, the technology that it has developed is now shared by a whole variety of agencies, including the FBI, so that this surveillance net that Frank Church warned so stridently about, in a way that if you stood up now, you'd be immediately branded as sort of shrill, self-marginalized radical, has come to be in all sorts of entrenched and legal ways. Now, there's a few ways to think about the surveillance state and to try and understand its scope and magnitude. And I think the most effective way to do that is just to look at a couple of numbers and to use the most mainstream sources to do that in terms of where we are in terms of the American surveillance state. So in 2010, the Washington Post published a three-part series called Top Secret America, written by their Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Dana Priest and William Arkin. And the first installment in that series looked at the national security state and the surveillance state and how it functions in the United States. And this was one of the sentences that appeared in this article. Listen to this. It said, quote, "Every day, collection systems at the National Security Agency intercept and store 1.7 billion emails, phone calls, and other types of communication." That's every day they intercept and store, they keep for as long as they want, 1.7 billion emails and other forms of telephonic communications. William Binney is a NSA official who was a fairly high-ranking NSA official for several decades, and he resigned in the wake of 9/11 because he was so outraged that the NSA was starting to be turned against the American people, and he resigned, and recently he's begun to speak out about the NSA's abuses. And he gave an interview on Democracy Now 3 weeks ago, and this is what he said about surveillance under the Obama administration. He said, quote, "Surveillance has increased every year since 9/11. In fact, I would suggest that they've assembled on the order of 20 trillion transactions about U.S. citizens with other U.S. citizens. 20 trillion transactions have been assembled by the NSA and its related agencies about U.S. citizens interacting with other U.S. citizens." He then went on to add that that's only emails and telephone calls and not things like financial transactions or other forms of video surveillance. So that pretty much tracks what the Washington Post reported as well. If you're storing 1.7 billion emails and telephone calls each and every day, it's likely that you'll fairly quickly reach the 20 trillion level that William Binney identified. Now, the most amazing thing about the surveillance state, given how incredibly ubiquitous it is and how incredibly menacing it is that we actually know very little about it. We're almost back to the mid-1970s when nobody even knew what the NSA was. The big joke in Washington whenever anyone would mention the NSA was that NSA stood for no such agency. It was just something that you were not permitted to talk about, even in government. No one knew what it did. We're basically at that point. We get little snippets of information, like the two statistics that I just described, that give us a sense of just how sprawling and all-encompassing the surveillance state is, but we don't very much know about who runs it, how it's operated, at whom it's directed, and who makes those decisions. And in fact, so clear is that lack of knowledge that there's an amazing controversy right now about the Patriot Act. You may remember in the aftermath of 9/11, the Patriot Act used to be something that was really controversial. In the September, October of 2001, Congress enacted this law and everyone ran around warning that it was this massive expansion of surveillance that was unlike anything we had ever seen before. It became the symbol of Bush-Cheney radicalism. Now the Patriot Act is completely uncontroversial. It gets renewed without any notice every 3 years with zero reforms, no matter which party is in control. And there are two Democratic senators who are very kind of mainstream, loyal Democratic Party supporters. They're President Obama supporters. They're like Frank Church, but even a little bit more mainstream within the Democratic Party. One is Ron Wyden of Oregon, and the other is Mark Udall of Colorado. And what these two Democratic Party senators have been doing for the last 3 years is running around warning that the Patriot Act is so much worse than anything that any of us thought all that time when we were objecting to it. And the reason it's so much worse is because the U.S. government has secretly interpreted it, what the Patriot Act permits it to do in terms of surveillance on American citizens, that's completely unrelated to what the law actually says, and it's something that almost nobody knows. Just listen to these two quotes that they gave to the New York Times a month ago. Senator Wyden said, quote, "I want to deliver a warning this afternoon. When the American people find out how their government has secretly interpreted the Patriot Act, they will be stunned and they will be angry." Now, he's talking about a different American people than the one that I know, but the point that he's making is that if you were paying attention and cared about these things the way you should, you would be stunned and angry to learn about what the government is doing, even under this already broad act. Senator Udall said, quote, "Americans would be alarmed if they knew how this law is being carried out." Now, They are two, as I said, establishment Democrats warning that the Democratic-controlled executive branch is massively abusing this already incredibly broad Patriot Act. And one of the things that they're trying to do is to extract some basic information from the NSA about what it is that they're doing in terms of the surveillance aimed at American people, because even though they're on the Intelligence Committee, the committee that the Church Committee created to oversee the intelligence community, they say they don't even know the most basic information about what the NSA does, including even how many Americans have had their emails read or telephone calls intercepted by the NSA. And so one of the things they did a couple months ago was they wrote a demand to the NSA saying, we don't want you to tell us anything sensitive. We just need to know the basic information about what it is that you're doing, such as, for example, the thing we really want to know is how many American citizens on U.S. soil have had their emails read by you and their telephone calls listened to you by you. That's what we want to know most of all. And the NSA responded 2 weeks ago by saying, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm not saying this for to be humorous, I'm not being ironic, I'm not snippeting out a part of it to distort it. Their answer was, look, we can't tell you how many millions of Americans are having their emails read by us and their telephone calls listened in by us, because for us to tell you that would violate the privacy of American citizens. And I mean, I just so you believe me, because if I were you, I would be thinking, oh, that's ridiculous. I don't know what whatever he's saying can't be true. I just want to read you from the letter that the head of the NSA wrote to the Senate Intelligence Committee in response. They said, quote, the NSA Inspector General and NSA leadership both agree that a review of the sort you're suggesting would itself violate the privacy of U.S. persons. So, you know, I think the important thing to realize is how little we know about what it is that they're doing, but the little that we do know is extraordinarily alarming in exactly the way that Frank Rich described. Now, I just want to make a couple of other points about the surveillance state that don't get enough attention, but that really are necessary for completing the picture about what it really is and what it does. We talk a lot about things like the NSA and federal government agencies like the FBI, but it actually expands well beyond that. We really live in a culture of surveillance. I mean, if you even go into any normal American city or even increasingly small and mid-sized towns, there are all kinds of instruments of surveillance everywhere that you probably don't even notice. If you wake up in the morning and drive to your local convenience store, you've undoubtedly been photographed by all sorts of surveillance cameras on the street. If you go to the ATM to take out money to buy things, that will be then recorded. If you go into a convenience store to buy the things you want to buy, you'll have your photograph taken and will be recorded. An article in Popular Mechanics in 2004 reported on a study of American surveillance, and this is what it said, quote, there are an estimated 30 million surveillance cameras now deployed in the United States, shooting 4 billion hours of footage a week. Americans are being watched, all of us, almost everywhere. There's a study in 2006 that estimated that that number would quadruple to 100 million cameras, surveillance cameras, in the United States within 5 years, largely because of the bonanza of post-9/11 surveillance money. And it's not just the government that is engaged in surveillance, but just as menacingly, corporations, private corporations, engage in huge amount of surveillance on us. They give us cell phones that track every moment where we are physically and then provide that to law enforcement agencies without so much as a search warrant. Obviously, credit card and banking transactions are recorded and tell anyone who wants to know everything that we do. When we talk about the scandal of the Bush eavesdropping program, that was not really a government eavesdropping program so much as it was a private industry eavesdropping program. It was done with the direct and full cooperation of AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, and the other telecom giants. In fact, when you talk about the American surveillance state, what you're really talking about is no longer public government agencies. What you're talking about is a full-scale merger between the federal government and industry. That is what the surveillance state is. They are equally important parts of what the surveillance state does. I think the most interesting and probably revealing example that I can give you about where we are in terms of surveillance in the United States was a really ironic and unintendedly amusing series of events that took place in mid-2011. What happened in mid-2011 was that the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which, as we know, are very, very oppressive and hate freedom, they said that what they were going to do was ban the use of BlackBerries and similar devices on their soil. And the reason is that the corporation that produces BlackBerries was either unable or unwilling to guarantee that Saudi and UAE intelligence agencies would be able to intercept all communications. And the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates were horrified by the prospect that people might be able to communicate on their soil without them being able to intercept and surveil that communication. And in response, they banned BlackBerries. And this created huge amounts of condemnation in the Western world. Every American newspaper editorialized about how this showed how much these governments were the enemies of freedom. The Obama administration issued a stinging denunciation of both governments, saying that they were engaged in the kinds of oppression that we couldn't tolerate. And yet 6 weeks later, the New York Times reported that the Obama administration was preparing legislation to mandate that all services that enable communications, I'm quoting from the New York Times, to mandate that all services that enable communications, including encrypted email transmitters like BlackBerry, social networking websites like Facebook, and software that allows direct peer-to-peer messaging like Skype, be designed to ensure government surveillance. It was exactly the same principle that everybody condemned the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for. The principle being that there can be no human interaction, especially no human communication, not just from foreign nationals and between foreign nationals, but by American citizens on American soil that is beyond the reach of the U.S. government. This was the mindset that in 2002 led the Bush administration to dredge up John Poindexter from wherever it was that he was, and he was actually working for defense contractors, and they dredged him up, and he was going to start the program that they called the Total Information Awareness Program. And the logo, which I actually looked at in the last couple of weeks that you should go and look at, just because you won't believe how creepy it is, has a pyramid with this huge eye hovering over it. This eye that was going to be the all-seeing eye. And the only problem with the Total Information Awareness Program was that they just put a name on it that was too honest about what it was, and it freaked everybody out, and so they had to pretend that they weren't going to go forward with it. But of course what they did was they've incrementally and in very clear ways recreated the Total Information Awareness Program under a whole variety of different legislative initiatives, and this idea that every single form of technological communication by law must be constructed to permit government backdoor interception and surveillance is an expression of what this surveillance state mindset is, that there can be no such thing as any form of privacy from the U.S. government. That is the mindset that has led the surveillance state to be this sprawling, vast, ubiquitous, and always expanding instrument that state and corporate power users employ in order to safeguard their power. The one other point that's worth making about how this works, about how the surveillance state works and how power is exercised through it, and this I think is probably the most pernicious part, and I refer to this as the one-way mirror, the government's one-way mirror. At exactly the same time, this is really so remarkable to me, at exactly the same time that the government has been massively expanding its ability to know everything that we're doing, it has simultaneously erected a wall of secrecy around it that prevents us from knowing anything that they're doing. There was this amazing controversy when the documents from WikiLeaks were disclosed and the American media had to rush to assure everybody simultaneously that this was both a completely meaningless act and a completely horrible act. So the two claims that were made was this horrible traitorous organization WikiLeaks has severely damaged American national security, but at the same time we want you to know there's nothing new in anything that they've disclosed. There's nothing worth knowing. That was literally the two claims that were made, and nobody ever bothered to reconcile those. But what was true is that of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages that WikiLeaks disclosed, it's actually in excess of 1 million now. there were the vast, vast bulk of it were very banal content. It was stuff that really wasn't particularly interesting, that didn't reveal very much about anything that was worth knowing. And what was actually so scandalous about that was that very fact, because every single page that WikiLeaks disclosed was stamped classified, and it made a crime to disclose any of it, even though so much of it was banal and revealed nothing worth knowing. And what that reflected is that the US government reflexively labels everything that it does of any conceivable significance as classified and secret. It keeps everything that it does from us at the very same time that it knows more and more about what we're doing. And if you think about how warped that is, what a radical reversal of how things are supposed to work, it's really startling. The idea is supposed to be, and this is just basic political science, basic design of the founding, that there's supposed to be transparency for government. We're supposed to know virtually everything that they do. Individuals are supposed to live in a sphere of privacy. Nobody's supposed to know what we're doing unless there's a demonstrated good reason to invade that wall of privacy. We've completely reversed that so that the government now operates with complete secrecy and we have none. And the reason this is so disturbing is you can just look at the famous aphorism typically attributed to Francis Bacon that knowledge is power. If I'm able to know everything about you, what you do, what you think, what you fear, where you go, what your aspirations are, the bad things that you do, the bad things you think about, and you know nothing about me, I have immense leverage over you in all kinds of ways. I can think about how to control you. I can blackmail you. I can figure out what your weaknesses are. I can manipulate you in all sorts of ways. That is the state of affairs that this surveillance state combined with the wall of secrecy has brought about. Now, I just want to talk a little bit about the mechanisms by which this has been done and the reasons why it matters so much, why this loss of privacy matters so much in relationship to the government and the corporate component of the surveillance state. If you look at the way in which the war on terror functioned in the first, say, 5 to 7 years after it was declared and the civil liberties abuses that it ushered in predictably and inevitably, you'll find that almost without exception, there are a few exceptions, but almost without exception, they were directed toward foreign nationals, not American citizens, but foreign nationals who were on foreign soil, not on U.S. soil. And the reason for that is that governments, when they want to give themselves abusive and radical powers, typically first target people who they think their citizens won't care very much about because they'll think they're not affected by it. And that's pretty much what happened. We detained without charges and without trials a bunch of Muslims who remain nameless, who we picked up in places that nobody really knew about or cared much about. We sent drones to assassinate them. All of these powers that were directed at foreign others. But what has happened over the last 3 to 4 years is a radical change in the war on terror. The war on terror has now been imported into United States policy. It is now directed at American citizens on American soil. So rather than simply sending drones to assassinate foreign nationals, we are now sending drones to target and kill American citizens without charges or trial. Rather than indefinitely detaining foreign nationals at Guantanamo, Congress last year enacted and President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act that permits the detention without trial indefinitely of American citizens on U.S. soil. Rather than sending drones only over Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan, drones are now being approved at an alarming rate, not just surveillance drones, but increasingly possibly weaponized drones that will fly over American soil, watching everything that we do in ways that, say, police helicopters could never possibly accomplish. Even when President Obama promised to close Guantanamo, and lots of his defenders will say, not inaccurately, that he was prevented from doing so because Congress blocked the closure, the plan that he had was not to close Guantanamo and eliminate the system of indefinite detention that made it so controversial. The plan was to take that system of indefinite detention, close Guantanamo because it had become an upsetting symbol, and import it, move it onto American soil in Thompson, Illinois. That was the plan that the Obama administration had for indefinite detention. And so what you see is this gradual importation of all of the abuses of the war on terror so that now they are entrenched and not just aimed at foreign nationals, but U.S. citizens on U.S. soil as well. That's the mechanism by which this is being done. If you listen to U.S. officials, intelligence and defense officials talk about terrorism, what they emphasize now is not al-Qaeda in Pakistan, which they'll largely acknowledge has been eliminated, or even al-Qaeda in Yemen, which isn't really much of a threat to anybody. What they'll talk about is the threat of homegrown terrorism. This is now the grave menace that American terrorism officials will warn needs to be restrained, and the solution to that has been the gradual transference of all of these abuses that we let take root because they weren't happening to us but were happening to people over there and are now being imported into domestic powers. And the reason that that's being done is not very difficult to see. American policymakers know that the financial unraveling that took place in 2008, that's even more visible in European states like Spain and Portugal and Greece, has never really been rectified, and it can't be rectified because these are structural problems. The way in which oligarchs in the United States monopolize wealth and then use that wealth to control our political processes ensure that this is not going to change. It's only going to worsen. Mass unemployment, mass foreclosure, all of these income inequality pathologies are here to stay. And the future that American policymakers see is visible if you look at what happened in London for a brief period of time, what happens all the time in Athens, what is happening with increasing frequency in Spain, huge amounts of social unrest. And you see lots of that happening. I think that's what the Occupy movement in many ways is. And the elites in the United States, both corporate and government, are petrified about that type of unrest. And what people in power always do when they fear unrest is they start consolidating power in order to constrain it, in order to suppress it. And this is what this surveillance state is designed to do. It's justified in the name of terrorism, of course. That's the packaging in which it's wrapped, but it's been used extremely and in all sorts of ways since 9/11 for domestic application. And that's happening even more. It's happening in terms of the Occupy movement and the infiltration that federal officials were able to accomplish using Patriot Act authorities. It's happened with pro-Palestinian activists in the United States and all other dissident groups that have themselves targeted with surveillance and law enforcement used by what was originally these war on terror powers. And I just want to close by talking about why I think this matters, because the attitude that you will typically encounter, and it's not a very easy mindset to address or to refute, is that, and it's one that government has sold continuously and peddled, which is, well, privacy in the abstract, I can understand why it's something to value, but ultimately, if I'm not really doing anything wrong, if I'm not one of the terrorists, if I'm not plotting to bomb a bridge, I don't really have much reason to care if people are invading my sphere of privacy and watching and learning what it is that I'm doing. And so I think it's worth talking about the reasons why that is such an ill-advised way to think, why it absolutely matters that privacy is being invaded in these systematic ways. I mean, one obvious answer is that any kind of social movement needs to be able to organize in private, away from the targets of the organization. So If you look at the revolutionary movements in the Arab world, one of the greatest challenges that they had was that the government sought all sorts of ways to prevent them from communicating from one another, either at all or in privacy. And the fact that the internet was not nearly as pervasive in those countries actually turned out to be a blessing because it enabled them to organize in more organic ways. But if the government is able to learn what we speak about and know who we're talking to and know what it is that we're planning, it makes any kind of activism extremely difficult because secrecy and privacy are prerequisites to effective activism. But I think the more difficult value of privacy, the one that's a lot harder to think about, is also the one that's much more important than just the one I described. And that is that it is in the private realm, exclusively, where things like dissent and creativity and challenges to orthodoxy reside. It's only when you know that you can explore without external judgment, or you can experiment without eyes being cast upon you? Is the opportunity for creating new paths possible? And there are all kinds of fascinating studies that prove this to be the case. There are psychological studies where people have sat down at their dinner table with family members or friends, and they are talking for a long time in a very informal way, and then suddenly one of them pulls out a tape recorder and puts it on the table and says, I'm going to tape record our conversation just for my own interest. I promise I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm not going to show it to anybody. No one's ever going to hear it. I'm just going to tape record it because I like to go over all the wisdom that you give me. And it's an experiment psychologically to assess what the impact of that is. And invariably what happens is the people who are now being recorded radically change their behavior. They speak in much more stilted sentences. They try and talk about much more high-minded topics. They're much stiffer in their expression of things because they now feel like they're being monitored. There was a pilot program in Los Angeles 6 or 7 years ago that was in response to a couple of exaggerated news stories about rambunctious school children, elementary age school children on buses who had apparently been bullying and abusing other students. And the solution that they came up with was that they were going to install surveillance cameras in every single public school bus in Los Angeles County, which is the second or third largest county in the United States. And the response when it was ultimately disclosed was, well, this is going to be extraordinarily expensive. I mean, how can you have tens of thousands of working surveillance cameras with people monitoring them or recording them every single day for every school bus in Los Angeles County? And the answer that they gave was, oh, no, we're not going to have working cameras in these buses. There may be a few buses that have working cameras, just so nobody knows which buses have those. We're going to have faux cameras, because we know that if we put cameras up, even though they're not working, that will radically change the behavior of students. In other words, we are training our young citizens to live in a culture where they expect that they are always being watched. And we want them to be chilled, and we want them to be deterred. We want them not to ever challenge orthodoxy or to explore limits or engage in creativity of any kind. This type of surveillance, by design, breeds conformism. That's its purpose. And that's what makes this surveillance so pernicious. Now, the last point I want to make is one of the things that, about the surveillance state, is one of the things that happens is that the way in which it affects how people think and behave is typically insidious. It's something that's very potent, and yet it's very easy to avoid understanding or realizing, even as it affects you. Now, sometimes people do know about the effects of the surveillance state and the climate of fear it creates, and it affects them. I went on a book tour last October and early November, and I went to 15 different cities. And in each of the cities, I really didn't care, honestly, about the book events. I was much more interested in going to the occupy encampments in each city and spending time there. It was much more enlightening and energizing. And One of the things that would happen is, literally almost the entirety of my book tour was taken up by talking about the Occupy movement. It was what everyone was thinking about. I had written many times that I thought it was by far the most significant political development in many years, and I still think that. And everywhere I would go that I would talk about the Occupy movement, literally all the time I would get people who would say things like, and I would be on radio shows and people would call in and say this, they would say, look, I'm really supportive of the Occupy movement. I want to go down there and be a participant in it, but I'm a woman who has a small baby, or I'm a man who has a bad leg, and given all the police abuse that's taking place there and all the infiltration, I'm just afraid of going and participating in these movements. That was definitely part of the effect that this infiltration and the police abuse had. It created this climate of fear in a way that people knew. I spend a lot of time with American Muslims and in American Muslim communities because of what I do and the work that I do and where I go and speak. And one of the things that emboldens me and keeps me very energized and engaged about these issues is if you go and speak to communities of American Muslims, what you'll find is an incredibly pervasive climate of fear. And the reason is that they know that they are always being watched. They know that they have FBI informants who are attempting to infiltrate their communities. They know that they have people next to them, their neighbors, their fellow Moscowers, who have been manipulated by the FBI to be informants. They know that they are being eavesdropped on when they speak on the telephone. They know that they are having their emails read when they speak or communicate to anybody. And what they will say all the time is that it has created this extreme suspicion within their own communities, within their own mosque, to the point where they're even afraid to talk to any new people about anything significant, because they fear quite rightly that this is all being done as part of a government effort to watch them. And it doesn't really matter whether it's true in a particular case or it isn't true. This climate of fear creates limits around the behavior in which they're willing to engage in very damaging ways. But I think what this surveillance state really does, more so than making people consciously aware of the limits, and those two examples that I just described, people not wanting to go to Occupy movements and people in Muslim communities being very guarded, is it makes people believe that they're free, even though they've been subtly convinced that there are things that they shouldn't do that they might want to do. I always use dog examples. I have 11 dogs, so it's one of the things that I know best. And I know you probably think I'm crazy, and maybe I am, but they're all rescue dogs, and so it's just one of the things that we do. And so I know dog behavior really well, and so I draw lessons a lot from dogs. And one of the things that's really amazing about dog behavior is, if you don't want dogs to go into a certain place because it's dangerous for them, one of the things that you can do is put a fence around the area where you want to confine them. But eventually, you can remove the fence, and you don't need the fence anymore, because they will have been trained that the entirety of their world is within the boundaries that you first set for them. So even once you remove the fence, they won't venture beyond it. They've been trained that that's the only world that they want or are interested in or know. There are studies in what was formerly East Germany, which was probably one of the most notorious surveillance states of the last 50 years, where even once their boundaries were removed, once the Stasi no longer existed, once the wall fell, the psychological effects on the East German people endure until today. Because the way in which they've been trained for decades to understand that there are limits to their life, even once you remove the limits, they've been trained that those are not limits they need to transgress. And that's one of the things that constantly surveilling people and constantly communicating to them that they're powerless before this omnipotent government corporate institution does to people. It convinces them that the tiny little box in which they live is really the only box in which they want to live, so they no longer even realize they're being imprisoned. Rosa Luxemburg put that best. She said, "He who does not move does not notice his chains." He who does not move does not notice his chains. You can acculturate people to believing that tyranny is freedom, that their limits are actually emancipation. And that is what this surveillance state most insidiously does, is by training people to accept their own conformity, that they are actually free. They no longer even realize the ways in which they're being limited. So the last point I just want to mention, and we can talk about this, I'm sure, in the discussion that follows, and probably will. It's usually what this discussions afterward entail, is what can be done about all of this. And there are just a few quick points that I want to make about that. One is that you can do things that remove yourself from the surveillance matrix, not completely, but to the best extent you can. There are people who only engage in transactions using cash. As inconvenient as that is, it at least removes that level of surveillance. There are ways to communicate on the internet using very effective forms of anonymity, which I will talk about in a minute. There's ways of educating yourself about how to engage in interaction and activism beyond the prying eye of the U.S. government, to say, in essence, a step ahead. There are important ways to educate yourself about the rights that you have when directly interacting with government agents. So much of what the government learns about people is because they let them learn that without having any legal obligation to do so. So much of government searches or government questioning is done under the manipulative pretext of consent, where people thought they had to consent or didn't know they had the right to, and give up information that they didn't need to give up. And educating yourself about what your rights are by going to the Center for Constitutional Rights website or the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms or the ACLU, lots of places online will tell you how to do that. A very important means of subverting this one-way mirror that I've described is forcible, radical transparency. It's one of the reasons that I support so enthusiastically and unqualifiedly groups like Anonymous and WikiLeaks. I want holes to be blown in the wall of secrecy, because the way in which this ends up operating effectively is only because they're able to conceal what they do. And that's why they consider these unauthorized means of transparency so threatening. And then the last point I want to make about things that can be done is there are groups that are pursuing very interesting and effective forms of anonymity on the internet. There's things like the Tor Project and other groups which enable people to use the internet without any detection from government authorities. That has the effect of preventing regimes that actually bar their citizens from using the internet from doing so, since you can no longer trace the origins of the internet user. But it also protects people who live in countries like ours, in which the government is constantly trying to monitor what we do by sending our communications through multiple proxies around the world in a way that can't be invaded. There's really a war taking place, an arms race, where the government and these groups are attempting to stay one technological step ahead of the other in terms of technological ability to shield internet communications from the government and the government's ability to invade them. And participating in this war in ways that are supportive of the good side are really critical, as is availing yourself of the technology that exists to make what you do as private as possible. I really don't think there's many more important fronts of battle, if there are any, than combating the surveillance state. So that's why I'm so interested in the topic, and why I'm so happy to be able to speak with you tonight about it. Thanks very much.
Now, firstly, on the subject of surveillance technology, I think almost everything you do on the internet is likely to get logged somewhere. That's the purpose of these huge data silos in the US. But if you use Skype or Instant Messenger, Yahoo, one of these large corporate control pieces of software, you're probably making things very easy for those who would like to monitor your every move and file it away for their unspoken purposes. I would recommend a piece of software called CryptoCat. This is open source, and I haven't looked at the source, and I'm not a cryptographer anyway, but I think it does have some pretty good cryptography, meaning even if people log your communication, they won't necessarily be able to understand any of it. It'll stay off the record, intelligible only to you and the person you communicate with. You have to download a browser add-in to make it work. The website from which that is available is crypto.cat. That's CRYPTO.CAT. As far as I'm concerned, the most important technology to change the linchpin of the whole hierarchical system, domination and control. And why was most of this technological grid built, or how was it built? By people not working for the love of it, but for the money. Last week I wrote up my thoughts. I'm planning out a piece of software, a decentralized gift economy, and I'd value your feedback and thoughts on that. The website is wiki.gifteconomy.org, and the name of the software is Edge. It's not yet available. This is only a sketched out plan, how it might work. I'm still in need of feedback, more ideas from interested parties before I get down to coding the prototype. And if you visit the website, you could edit it there, or you can send me feedback directly. My email is unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive on welcomeguest.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope the show has helped you grasp more fully the Potemkin nature of justice in the US and the need to stand up and assert your personal philosophy, doing what you think is right, never minding the consequences.